And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to The Food Show. I'm Emily Becker. On today's show, we'll hear about how our local food system is changing and adapting to life during COVID-19 times. First up is Jason Skipton, Executive Director of Growing Gardens, talking about how his organization is building home gardens and helping inmates grow food despite the challenging times. And if you want to hone your gardening skills, stay tuned because Growing Gardens is offering virtual garden consultations. I also spoke with Brooke Jackson Glidden, the editor of Eater PDX, about the impacts of coronavirus on the restaurant industry in Portland. Some restaurants are able to do takeout right now, but others are shutting their doors permanently, leaving many workers unemployed. We'll dive into the ways restaurants are being innovative and helping to care for workers in our community. At the end of the hour, we'll hear a bit of bright news. Many farmers markets are open. Farmers markets have quickly adapted to create a safe outdoor shopping experience. Ian Rose of Portland Farmers Markets will tell us about the changes at the market and what you can do to be prepared to buy direct from local farmers and small businesses. Before we dive in, I want to ask our listeners to consider making a donation to KBOO. Due to the coronavirus crisis, KBOO had to cancel our spring membership drive. As a listener-supported community radio station, we need your support more than ever. If you're able to, please go to kboo.fm/give and make a donation today. Thank you.
Jason Skipton is the executive director at Growing Gardens, an organization that helps people learn to grow food in schools, backyards, and correctional facilities. Thanks so much for being here today, Jason.
Emily, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The virus is impacting us all in so many different ways. And we know that small businesses and nonprofits are going through a lot right now, trying to stay open, trying to keep their employees, and really changing their models to adapt to the situation. And we're going to get into all of that. But for right now, you know, in normal times, what kinds of programs does Growing Gardens operate?
Growing Gardens, historically, you know, we're almost an organization that's been around for 25 years. We have three main programs. The roots to our program is the Home Gardens program, where we work with about 300 low-income families to get gardens built in their backyards. And then we provide mentor supports and direct support on gardening for 3 years. So really, none of our programs that I'm going to talk about are like a drop-in program or here's a seed packet or here's a plant, I hope it works out, because we know that that's just not a successful model. Like, our work is really built around relationships. So our Home Gardens program, you know, decentralized its model about 5 years ago, meaning we started to then hire program graduates. So folks who went through the three-year program then were hired on as staff and then are working and organizing in their own neighborhoods across the city. The other program, Youth Grow, is a program where we're working in 10 elementary schools and one high school, where we're doing garden-based education and connecting math, science, you know, STEM and STEAM education into the garden. You know, we bring a teacher to every school. We co-teach with every grade level and every teacher. And we get kids outside and get them excited about science and math, but also about eating fresh, healthy produce that's grown right on school property. And then our last program is called Let Us Grow, where we're working in 16 correctional facilities across the state of Oregon, providing 9 months of horticulture education, and then hands-on production. Last year, in all of the sites that we work in, we helped grow about 300,000 pounds of fresh organic produce that went back into prison meals for inmates to then eat healthy, fresh food. So kind of like the three tenets across our programs are really providing access to healthy food, quality education, and then building positive social networks no matter where you live in the state of Oregon.
That's awesome. Maybe that last part is one of the hardest to maintain right now. Just it's harder to do community building when you can't be face-to-face, right? So let's talk a little bit about how COVID-19 is impacting your work and the changes you've made to keep your participants and staff safe.
Yeah, you know, we're adapting and shifting and pivoting our work every day. COVID-19 crisis right now has really impacted all of our work. So in our home gardens program, you know, on average, we get 200, 250 volunteers that come out in the month of April. And they help us build home gardens. We were set up to build 40 home gardens in the month of April. And our home gardens manager, Antonio, was like, look, we can't not do this. Like, we have to do this. I know we have to do this in a different way. And so he was like, you know, give me a week and let me figure out a plan of what this is going to look like without volunteers. Because, you know, in April, it was just like we can't safely do volunteer events, you know, with a public health crisis that's happening. Antonio developed an amazing plan, which, you know, I've just called like micro team garden build. So it was him, Antonio, as like the main like lead. And then he had one other growing garden staff person that would kind of rotate each day with him. And he set a plan and said, look, I'm going to build gardens every day of the week. And then by the end of April, you know, early May, we're going to complete all of these 40 gardens. And there were several reasons why. One, it's springtime here in Portland, and like this is the best opportunity to get started with year-long growing now. Two, we had committed to these families last year that we were going to then work with them and get gardens built with them. And then three, right now, food insecurity is so high that we couldn't wait to see what happens, that we had to really get families, you know, the resources and access they need right now to then build lifelong family food security. He developed this amazing plan, and then I'm super happy to report he completed all 40 gardens a week earlier than scheduled. He was out there every single day working and building these gardens with community. You know, a lot of them were, you know, social distance practices were obviously front of mind, wearing masks, bringing hand washing stations, and also bringing, you know, hand sanitizer. Again, because we wanted to ensure that our teams were being safe, but also our partners in our community were being safe. So that's kind of like one pivot, having to go from like normally relying on a big batch of volunteers to being like one or two people are going to do this. Like, that was a big shift. Then we started really seeing this huge kind of interest and questions and emails from people who really wanted to start their own garden. And so we launched a virtual gardening consultation service really for anyone who wanted to have one-on-one garden support on how do I get a garden started, or I've never done this, or I'm a little intimidated by this, how do I do this? And so this was kind of the organization's first time to really open up our doors to like really anyone. All of our programs have been really focused on low-income families or low-income communities that haven't had this resource or access to this kind of garden education and community building. So this was an opportunity for us to really open up our doors for anyone. So we launched that about a month ago to really provide that support around education, but also answering a lot of questions and trying to demystify what growing your own food looks like here in Portland. So then, you know, we're kind of in the midst of this one right now, too. This is also a really interesting kind of pivot, but every May, you know, kind of mid-May, we hand out and have a plant distribution day. We hand out over 4,000 plant starts to about, wow, you know, 400 families that come. The idea, and we're like, well, we can't have, you know, 400 families show up. It's actually like this really great community celebration. People have been part of, you know, Growing Gardens, Home Gardens program, have been able to come back and kind of see each other. It's kind of like a mini reunion, right, for folks who are in their cohort. Well, we can't do that this year. So, again, Antonio and our Home Gardens director, Riche, have developed this plan of, well, let's really utilize our decentralized model with community organizers to then basically bring all the plant starts here to our office, consolidate them, organize them, catalog them, and then divide them up and then deliver them to the community organizers across the metro area. And then the community organizers are going to then work just with their cohort of families to then come and pick up plants from their house. Again, utilizing social distancing practices. Folks are going to drive up to the community organizer's house. They're going to, you know, tell them, they've already emailed them their order. Community organizer is going to come out and then put the plants either in the back of their car or in the trunk or in the back seat, so there's no, you know, contact whatsoever. And then the next person's going to come up. So we're utilizing our decentralized model in a way that is then keeping our team safe, but also keeping our community safe, but is also then getting these very needed and essential plant starts out to these folks.
Yeah.
One really amazing thing is there's been such an outpouring of support around plants, is that normally we've done 4,000 plant starts, and these are all grown by volunteers who started growing these plants in January. This year, we're going to do over 7,000 plant starts.
That's impressive.
It's mind-boggling, and here's the thing that I really want to make sure, like, gets across, is the Growing Gardens team is so dedicated to the community, is so focused on ensuring that resources, especially in this time, especially to get resources to food and education and growing your own food, they are pushing every boundaries that they possibly can, and they're being so creative and so innovative at this time that, to me, it's just amazing to watch that these folks can come together and create an idea in very difficult times and then try and test it and be extremely successful. So really, I'm so proud of our team.
So if somebody was interested in doing the virtual garden consultation, how would they get that service?
Yeah, so they would just go to our website, you know, growing-gardens.org, and up at the top banner, you'll see garden consultation. And so you click on that, and basically it's a really simple Google form that you fill out, you know, what's your name, what's your address. And we only ask for addresses because we use Google Map to then figure out, okay, what are you telling us? Where do you want to put this garden? Or, in our opinion, this is the best place to put the garden. And then there's just simple questions on, like, what do you want to learn? Like, what's possible? And then they select a time that works for their schedule. Then one of our garden consultants follows up with them and says, hey, you know, I have you scheduled for this date. This is what I see you want to learn. Then they schedule a time on what platform works best for that individual. So it could be a phone call, it could be a Zoom call, it could be a Google Hangout, it could be a WhatsApp call, it could be a FaceTime, really whatever works for that person. And then they hold a 30-minute garden consultation and ask all of the questions or answer all of the questions that the person might have. And then they follow up with a pretty extensive email of like, okay, we talked about these things, here's some resources, here's where you can go and get these things. And then, you know, send out that email to the individual.
Has that been successful so far?
Yeah, you know, we've done almost 30 garden consultations in the last month.
That's great. Is that helping you keep all of your staff working full time?
Right. Yeah, it's a part of it. And so I would say, like, we are busy. We are as busy, if not busier, than what we were normally. Right. So we are keeping our teams engaged. We're keeping our teams at the FTE that they want to be at.
So let's talk a little bit about the Let Us Grow program. There's, as far as I understand it, no visitors are allowed to go into correctional facilities right now. So how is that program working?
Yeah, so this one's difficult. This one's tough because, you know, normally, I mean, these are pretty tough conditions for our program staff to work with anyways. You're right. Yeah, there has been no outside educators, consultants that have been allowed into Oregon Department of Correction facilities for about the last, 45, 50 days. No real end date to that has been set forth. So what we've done is really before the stay-at-home orders happened, we sent out boxes and boxes of seeds to every correctional facility that we have a partnership with so that they would then at least have a stockpile of seeds to then get their gardens planted. We've also connected with Coffee Creek Correctional Facility and Columbia River Correctional Institute here in Portland, and we've been able to then get them and drop off soil and tomato plant starts. So just this last week, we dropped off over 300 tomato starts to both sites. Outside the facility, a correctional officer then came out and picked up the plant starts and brought them back into the facility. We've also had some communication, email or phone calls with Department of Correction staff on getting their support to then have them kind of be our hands inside the facility while we're helping give them and provide them direction through email and other follow-up communication to ensure that gardens are then being planted and grown right now.
Because that would normally be your staff person going into the facility and doing that work, and now they're advising somebody whose job has nothing to do with growing food, right, on how to help the other people that are there to grow things together.
Yeah, and I would also say, utilizing the skill, like we've been teaching, horticulture education in correctional facilities for the last 10 years. So really utilizing those folks who have had these courses to then be like, okay, like you're the lead person now, like you got to make sure that this is going to happen. And Department of Correction is also seeing like, wow, like this has been such a huge benefit and asset. Like we have to figure out how to then continue to make this work. And so we've had, Department of Corrections folks reach out to us and email us and say, hey, what do I need to do? How can we make this happen? Give us some, pointers and advice on what do we need to do to ensure that we're going to be able to grow, 300,000 pounds of produce in our facilities. Like, so basically trying to guide through technology to then ensure that our programs continue.
So the produce that's grown actually stays at the facility and goes into the cafeteria, right? That's correct?
Yeah, so about of the 300,000 pounds, about 95% of what was grown or what is grown, yeah, goes directly into the correctional facility cafeteria, and then inmates get to enjoy it. So, yeah, about 95%. Another, 5-6% is donated to local food banks. I think the biggest impact, honestly, will be that Oregon inmates won't have access to healthy food that tastes like something that they remember, right? That actually tastes like food.
Yeah.
And also think about like the mental health impact of that, is that there's a change in the facility once the tomato season opens up, right? And folks are bringing in fresh tomatoes. Think about that humanity and think about that sense of those memories that you have of, when you put that, vine ripened tomato in your mouth, and that feeling that you get and that nostalgia, or that place that it actually can transport you as an individual outside of a correctional facility with one bite of amazing garden produced produce, those experiences will be diminished.
Yeah, it's an excellent point and a really good reason that it's so important that Growing Gardens and other organizations that are doing all kinds of important work are able to continue. And I know that funding is tight right now for basically everybody. But what's, just kind of quickly, like what's going on with your funding situation and how can people support Growing Gardens?
So, I'm going to be super honest about this and kind of tell you all like the process that we're going through and, what we have to do around, budgeting. And we had already a 2020 budget, which we've had to revise several times in the last month just because of the uncertainty. So, as an organization, we're fighting every day to ensure that, funding is available and that we have enough for our staff. We as an organization rely on individuals to donate to our organization, also to attend our events. We've had to basically cancel all of those or pivot those. And so our community brunch is going to be done virtually this year. Our Chef in My Garden series will not be large gatherings of people coming together, we're going to redub that and call it Chef in Your Garden, where we're going to then work with restaurants and have them make specific special baskets for Chef in Your Garden participants to then come and either pick up from the restaurant or have delivered to your home. And then you're going to be able to enjoy that amazing meal in your own garden. Restaurants have supported our work for the last 17 years. That's how long we've done Chef in My Garden, for 17 years. This is really our chance and our opportunity to step up and say, you know what, restaurants, we know you're really struggling. We want to then support you as well in this process. And so we're working with restaurants on this idea of, if somebody buys a ticket to Chef in Your Garden, that a portion of that ticket is going to go directly to the restaurant. And so, again, like, this is our chance and our opportunity to really support our entire community and our entire food system.
Wow, that's a really amazing idea. I think there's we all know restaurants are struggling right now, and such a great idea to support each other, like both an excellent community organization and supporting our local economy through supporting restaurants. So that's really exciting to hear. So if anybody wants more information about any of those programs, go to growing-gardens.org, or I'm sure look at Instagram. You guys got pretty pictures up all the time. And thanks so much for being here today, Jason.
Emily, thanks so much. I guess I could just add just like kind of like three action items just real fast, you know, for folks how they can support our work. One, if you wanted and had the ability to make a monthly donation and become a perennial donor to Growing Gardens, if you really believe and want to support the work that we're doing, you know, attend our virtual brunch. It's going to be on June 27th. We're going to have some fun with it. We're going to do a lot of storytelling. You know, if you want to do a Chef in Your Garden and participate in that, like, you know, buy a ticket for that. Get and sign up for a virtual garden consultation would also be another way to then support our work.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jason.
Thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity. Stay healthy.
I'm joined now by Brooke Jackson Glidden. She's the editor of Eater Portland and has been writing regularly about the impacts of COVID-19 on the restaurant industry in Portland. Thanks so much for talking with me today, Brooke.
Happy to be here, virtually.
Yeah, virtually. So let's start out with an overview of what's happened since we all became aware of the coronavirus. You know, what, you know, the Governor Brown has issued a lot of orders, and we've moved to most restaurants being shut down, doing takeout only, that sort of thing. Like, what's going on right now, and what's been happening?
So the beginning of March was a really interesting moment, because usually the start of Portland Dining Month, basically things really started to slow down around then. People became more aware of coronavirus. There were more cases starting to enter Multnomah County and throughout the state. On March 17th, that was the first day that restaurants and bars had to shut down for dine-in service. Before that, people were sort of electing to close or switch to takeout. I think Beetroot was one of the first places to choose on their own accord to close for dine-in. But March 17th, the executive order was issued on the 16th. It went in place on the 17th. All dining rooms and bars had to shut down. And, you know, many people switched to takeout or delivery, but generally there was this big hope from restaurant owners before even the executive order went into place that they might be able to file an interrupted business claim and that they could make sure that their employees could stay safe. So a lot of people were actually calling for that, you know, state shutdown before it happened on the 17th. Unfortunately, it turns out most of those insurance companies didn't actually cover situations like this. So generally what happened was people were calling for the state to shut down. It shut down. All these restaurant owners filed these claims and they were unsuccessful. So at that point, that's when, you know, things really started to suffer economically, I think, in a more substantial way than before. You know, a lot of people were laid off. And, you know, a lot of restaurants closed temporarily, weren't doing any sort of takeout or delivery. And the restaurants that were open, you know, mainly it was just the business owners or one or two employees in the kitchen filling out orders. Meanwhile, restaurant workers were either getting unemployment and maybe making more than they were when they were actually in the kitchen working or serving. Or in many, many cases, they were unable to successfully file a claim. and, you know, they're making absolutely nothing. This is still very true for a lot of restaurant workers in the Portland area. They have been unable to get those unemployment claims. So a lot of people are living with no real form of income right now, or they are essentially, you know, getting jobs at grocery stores because that's the only thing they can find.
Yeah, it's a really it's a hard situation to be in for lots of people. You know, even people working in restaurants right now, I imagine it's actually kind of extra stressful to, you maybe aren't dealing with customers as much face-to-face, but you are dealing with people on the phone or like taking orders online and dealing with delivery services. It just seems like it's, you know, the stress of kind of shifting your entire business is got to be hard too.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the people who have been open, they've shown a lot of anxiety surrounding the premise of being open. I think a lot of people are, you know, if they own a food cart, for instance, a lot of food cart owners have been telling me that they felt really anxious serving people because, you know, a lot of people weren't wearing masks or they were choosing to eat there even though they were not supposed to. You know, a lot of folks there have been feeling, you know, unsafe. And there are also the issues that there are a lot of restaurant workers who are immunocompromised or live with asthma and feel particularly anxious working right now. So, you know, even if people are working, they don't necessarily feel safe doing it. So, you know, it's caused a lot of stress whether you're choosing to stay open or not. And, you know, a lot of people are going to be transitioning to opening for dine-in service right now. Last week, Kate Brown announced that counties would be able to apply to begin phase one reopening, you know, which means a number of businesses, including restaurants and bars. But there are a lot of people who don't want people in their dining rooms, and that's true around the state.
You know, in that shift from restaurants moving from dine-in to being takeout and delivery only, what kinds of changes are you seeing?
You know, it's been really fascinating to watch people pivot in that way. And there's been a lot of creativity in terms of business shifts. You know, many restaurants are starting larder-style businesses where customers can buy groceries or family meals or meal kits instead of just, you know, the usual takeout from what was on the original restaurant menu. And even, you know, many are even offering something completely different from what they normally do. Like, Stevens started serving Italian-American food, and Revelry started serving things like cabbage rolls and pasta. We're seeing people creating new delivery systems, like At Your Door, which is a new delivery app from the owners of Botanist Bar, which delivers spirits, beer, wine, stuff like that. So I think a lot of people are getting really creative with how they're choosing to tackle takeout and delivery right now.
I do want to talk a little bit about the impact on restaurant workers. I know a lot of people have been laid off. Do you have any sense of a percentage of restaurant workers that are out of work?
Yes, so many restaurant workers have been laid off right now, and so many of them have been unable to get unemployment benefits because of the surge of requests. The Oregonian published a story last month saying that the computers themselves processing those claims are a huge issue because they're so old and outdated that those claims aren't actually getting through. Regardless, a lot of people are still, you know, getting those benefits, either or they're not. You know, it's really been kind of a crapshoot whether or not you're going to be able to get your unemployment benefits. And the people who are able to return to work are not necessarily interested in doing that. You know, either they're immunocompromised or they live with asthma or they live with someone who's immunocompromised. So there has been, you know, a ton of reasons that people are really actively not looking to work right now as restaurant workers. Either they're sick or, you know, they have kids, they have to take care of kids. There are so many reasons that people don't want to be working right now. And that's been difficult for restaurant owners who feel really obligated to reopen. And that's also been difficult for people who are, you know, trying to find employees, you know. So it's been kind of an interesting period of looking at how the restaurant labor force works. There was already a labor shortage, and suddenly there is this very difficult tension, I think, between a lot of restaurant owners who maybe want to start doing a bigger takeout format or want to hire people back because they've received PPP loans, and the people who work for them really feeling hesitant to do that. Then again, you know, it goes back and forth. People either want to work or want to get paid in some way and are unable to, or they don't want to work and they want to stay safe, and that's been a problem for us homeowners.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I hadn't thought about that kind of labor shortage issue being compounded by this now. So then I think, you know, something that I've been thinking about too is that there's all of these places that, you know, they make a beautiful meal for you or a great burger or whatever it is, but that's not really how the business survives. It's really based on alcohol sales. And just with, you know, not being able to dine in and drink while you're having a meal, it's got to be impacting people even more. I'm wondering if you've heard anything from restaurant owners about, like, how they're making it work just doing the kind of takeout and delivery.
You know, I think that Portland in general loves its bars. It loves its dive bars. It loves breweries. You know, it alcohol sales are a huge part of the industry here in Portland. And, you know, it's been incredibly difficult for people not to be able to sell cocktails in any way, you know. And many bars are still feeling really left out. You know, they don't really have a restaurant following. People don't necessarily look to them for food, and, you know, alcohol might be their main form of income. So they just have been kind of stuck, you know. They just really haven't been able to find any sort of income in that way.
Some restaurants have been able to get different kinds of loans to help them out right now, but the future is just seems very uncertain for a lot of restaurants, and a lot of them have just decided to close. So I know you have a list that you're tracking of restaurants that have actually closed permanently or that are completely restructuring how they're going to do things in the future. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing as far as restaurant closures?
You know, I think what's been really tough for a lot of people in terms of trying to stay open is that they, you know, they apply for these PPP loans and then they receive the loans, but, you know, the actual way to get forgiveness on those loans is very unclear right now. A lot of people are really confused about how many people they have to hire back and when, if they want loan forgiveness, what percentage of staff, and, you know, people are having a lot of trouble rehiring staff. So, you know, it becomes this question of, am I willing to accept all this money and have to pay it all back when I'm already entering the industry at a really hard time and I can't necessarily hire everyone back right now? Because people have been in that situation, some people have just chosen to completely opt out and close. And I think that a lot of people have felt that, you know, the prospect of reopening with, you know, these specific restrictions in place, the phase one restrictions, they just can't necessarily figure out a feasible way to continue moving forward. So, you know, many restaurants in Portland have already closed permanently. That includes long-standing neighborhood staples like Orlando Library Bakery and Cafe or Helzer's, and places like Noroneko and Blackheart have announced permanent closures.
In a normal year, a lot of restaurants close, right? Like, it's it's a normal cycle that we see. You have so many restaurants in Portland. We see it all the time. But is there any way to kind of quantify it or, like, help us see the difference between what's normal and what's going on right now?
You know, I think that, you know, personally, we've spotted about 11 permanent closures in Portland, and that's actually low compared to other periods of time. We saw a lot of closures last year in the hundreds. You know, that number is going to rise exponentially. A lot of places are closing permanently and don't feel ready to announce yet, and a lot of places are still considering whether or not they're going to close permanently and eventually will land that way. Some places are going to close and not announce it at all. It's going to be really hard to get a firm number of how many places are simply just not going to reopen. But that number of 11, that's tip of the iceberg. We're going to be seeing a lot more in the next few months.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, the thing that we're seeing right now is that restaurants outside of Portland have started to reopen for dine-in service. And so that's that phase one opening where Restaurants have to close by 10 p.m. They have to operate at limited capacity. They have to space their tables out. They have to wear masks and, you know, all of these new changes that are going to really change what it's like to go to a restaurant. I guess I'm kind of curious what you've heard from restaurant owners about whether that's going to work for them. Are they going to be able to actually operate a business and not lose a lot of money at very limited capacity?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Some people are very, very frustrated with the rules regarding curfew specifically. Kurt Hoffman at Chef's Table, the restaurant group behind places like Ox and Lardo and St. Jack, he's been an outspoken critic of the idea of a curfew. Most people seem fine with the sort of health and safety precautions, wearing masks. And while many people understand why those table spacing rules are in place, that they have to keep 6 feet of distance, they just don't see it working in their businesses. It's hard for a bar with bar seating to create that kind of space, right? When I talked to Justin King at Blackheart, he said that he didn't have a problem with the guidelines. In fact, he liked the guidelines, but his space was just not going to be able to accommodate that. You know, I've noticed that in general, several restaurant owners are very hesitant to reopen dining rooms. Even with the potential phase one reopening happening next month, you know, we have no real idea of when that's going to actually go into place in Portland. There's a lot that still needs to be done. But, you know, there are people who are, you know, adamant. Chef's Table won't reopen dining rooms until August. And, you know, Peter and Son at Hon Oak, they're saying they're waiting until there's a vaccine. That could be over a year from now. So I think, you know, when Portland actually reopens, there are going to be a lot of people who announce their permanent closures then because they realize they just can't accommodate that phase one reopening and what those restrictions look like. And there are a lot of people who are going to really wait it out until they can open the way that they've been operating beforehand.
You know, kind of what I've been thinking about is that all of these changes really add up to very significant changes in Portland food culture, and we know that our restaurant culture is a deeply integrated part of our culture as a city and our economy. And then kind of on like a larger scale, just that things are really going to need to shift with how we treat restaurant workers and the culture of actually working in a restaurant. You know, sick time is not a thing. Like, people don't get health insurance. Right. People often don't take breaks. They're working long shifts where they're not actually able to go wash their hands all the time, like whatever it is, or take a break just like to feel better about dealing with this kind of constant pressure. And that's just a thing that when it's just the norm, right? And it seems like one of those things that might need to change going forward. Have you had any conversations with restaurant owners and workers kind of about what might be changing in how we work in restaurants and how restaurants are part of our culture?
You know, you got to hope that people will start changing those health insurance plans, sick leave policy, break policies, because you're right. You know, there is really a culture of people working while sick. And, you know, COVID, it doesn't behave like a foodborne illness, you know, in many ways. But, you know, people have been working while sick in restaurants for years and years and years and years. It's one of the largest reasons that norovirus spreads, you know, is that sick workers are going in and, you know, working and passing that way. Coronavirus doesn't generally, from what we've seen, behave that way. But, you know, if people are going to be dining in restaurants and servers are going to be working while sick, we could be in a very similar position years from now, especially if we don't have a vaccine. Or, you know, this could emerge with a different bug. You know, there are several other outbreaks that have occurred like this in other places around the world. I don't think that we're going to be immune from these kind of pandemics. You know, people have been expecting superbugs for a really long time. So I think that, you know, generally this is going to be something we have to live with. So I really do hope that this happens, that more restaurant workers are going to allow for more than the mandatory amount of sick leave, paid sick leave. And you know, they're going to allow for more than the allotted or necessary health insurance for their employees. But I'm not entirely sure they will. Restaurants are really struggling right now, and I think many restaurant owners feel that they can't raise prices enough to accommodate a change like that. Then again, many other restaurant owners, people like Maya Lovelace at May and Yonder, have said that changing restaurant culture to accommodate more self-care to keep people healthy is just going to have to happen. You know, that might mean a higher ticket price at restaurants.
Yeah, it's quite a balance for anybody trying to run a business, right? Like taking care of your workers and taking care of your customers and also making sure you can do it without having to close. So it's just, I think I actually, in one of your pieces, that it's a bunch of kind of responses from restaurant owners. Maya Lovelace basically said, she's just like, we have to figure this out. Like, we just can't go on doing this. Like, and I think that's like really powerful to hear people, you know, who knew all along they've been in this very unhealthy work environment for a very, very long time and perpetuating this kind of culture of it doesn't matter how you're feeling, you show up and get the work done, to how to, you know, realizing we actually have to change that. And that's such a big cultural shift and like, you know, something that only this coronavirus could have maybe pushed us to make. So one potential positive moving forward. I know that shrinking of the restaurant industry, it's not just impacting food service workers and people who want to go to restaurants, but it's also impacting the people that grow food, that raise animals, and other small businesses that restaurants are purchasing from. Do you have any sense of kind of what's the bigger impact on the economy with all of the restaurants simplifying their menus, shutting down, switching to takeout, that sort of thing?
It's been really interesting because, you know, the restaurant industry, the food industry in general, is massive, right? And it impacts so much of the economy at large, you know, from real estate to agriculture to technology to, you know, just sort of unseen members of the restaurant industry, you know, the people who do the linens for restaurants, you know, the people, plumbers, electricians, you know, the restaurant industry is huge, and it's a huge part of the Portland economy especially. I think that seeing that impact seep through the restaurant industry and other industries has been really painful for a lot of people. And a lot of restaurant owners I've talked to have felt very specifically worried for their farmers, the people that are providing their vegetables, their fruits, their meat. What's been interesting is to see people create their own sort of CSAs, produce boxes, farm boxes, so they can still buy from their suppliers and sell them to their restaurant customers. You know, you're seeing that all over the place. You're seeing that at Cocaine, at Ava Jean's and Submarine Hospitality, Paley's Place. You know, people are really trying to still support the people who, you know, grow, raise their food in new and different ways.
I love that idea of the restaurants that are becoming kind of like CSA pickup points, basically, right? Or putting together meal boxes or something just that's supporting the farmers that they work with and then also helping the restaurant out. And it's just another example of all the creativity and innovation that is coming out of this time right now.
Many restaurants are going to really dramatically have to pivot how they work. And that's going to feel, I think, like a big loss for the Portland restaurant scene. However, what's been really inspiring is seeing the ways that people have fostered community in the restaurant industry by taking care of each other. You know, places like Mata, Villain, Desi, Botanist, they've been giving away free meals to unemployed restaurant workers, people in need. You know, there are places that are developing these pay-it-forward models where people can buy meals for those who need a free one. You know, that's happening at places like Malka and Toro Bravo. And even there are organizations like Frontline Foods that are paying restaurants and restaurant workers to make free meals for hospital workers and frontline workers. And I think that has been the sort of new form of community building that, you know, maybe we won't be able to sit around a table and share a meal together as strangers, but maybe we're going to support each other anyway and make sure that everyone's not getting too hippie here. But I think that has been inspiring to me as someone who covers this industry.
Yeah, there's so much inspiration to be found in what we're all doing, and it's so lovely to see that people are taking care of each other right now. Thanks for sharing all of those stories. If people want to read your stories, where can they find them?
So all of my stories are at pdx.eater.com. We're churning out a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff to follow right now, so feel free to check that out if you're looking for takeout or just what's happening right now.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Brooke.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Ian Rose is the Communications and Marketing Manager of Portland Farmers Market, which operates 5 farmers markets, including the massive PSU market. Farmers markets are making lots of changes right now to make sure that they're keeping vendors and shoppers safe due to COVID-19. Ian, tell us about what farmers markets are going to be like this year.
I mean, it's like everything, we look very different than we did 3 months ago. You know, like you said, the PSU market is a big one, and it's also kind of unusual in that it's a year-round market, where a lot of them are just seasonal. And so we were already, you know, running week by week when this happened. We were able to start our procedures, you know, before we had to, right when we started hearing that things were going to be different. And so we, you know, we started controlling entrances and restricting the number of people in the space. We have, you know, before we were told to by the state or the city, we made sure that all of our vendors and staff were wearing masks and gloves, started sanitation procedures as far as wiping all the surfaces down. So it does look different. I mean, I think if someone had not been to a farmer's market since last year, they would expect to see things like live music, which isn't happening and won't happen for quite a long time, and demonstrations and chefs in the market and things like that. And so all that has had to go. What we've found is that our core purpose has always been about connecting the city with the best fresh food that's being grown in the region. And that's still the core of what we do. We just had to remove some of the other stuff that was a lot of fun and that was really, and sometimes was really helpful, but right now we are just an essential source of food.
What kinds of things are vendors doing differently now that's kind of changing that shopping experience?
There's sort of two levels. I mean, first off, some vendors are beginning to offer more and more access to their food outside of the market. And so we have a page on our website that lists 102 of our about 200 total vendors who are doing things like deliveries and pickups and pre-order for market. And because there are people that, no matter what we do, are not going to feel comfortable coming to the market, and so we still want to get them their food. But at market, they're also doing things like, again, wearing masks and gloves. We've changed the layout of our markets so that the booths are farther apart from each other. They are doing things. A lot of the thing that we wouldn't have really thought of before this crisis is the transaction process when you're paying was a lot of the interaction between, you know, sort of the hand-to-hand interaction between people. And we've made that about as no touch as we possibly can. Most of our vendors, you're able to just, you know, to never hand over your card. Or anything, they will just have the reader there for you to put it into. And also separating the transaction from the handling of food. Anyone who handles money is not handling food. And so it's just removing as many possible risks as we can. And that's really, and all of our vendors have done a lot of work toward that.
And somebody evaluating where they will feel comfortable shopping, you know, what else should they be thinking about if they're going to choose to go to the farmer's market as opposed to, like, go to a grocery store?
I think it really comes down to what each individual person is comfortable with. I think there are advantages to the farmer's market in that we can space people out in a way that a grocery store is not able to, because we can change our entire layout. We don't have sort of set aisles, and we've done a lot of that. Grocery stores also have advantages, like they're able to be open more often than we are, and have a different variety of food, and that we concentrate on really the seasonal things being grown here in the region, which luckily, you know, we're lucky enough to be in a place with a lot of that.
Yeah, I think for me personally, just that they're outside helps a lot. To think about, you know, being in an enclosed space for an hour feels a lot different than shopping in an outdoor environment. But, you know, something that a lot of grocery stores or other businesses are doing right now is limiting capacity. Is that something that the farmers markets are doing?
Yes, I think particularly at places like PSU. We right now, three of our five markets are opening. The other two are going to be opening in June. And we are always monitoring the numbers of people in our markets. In a few of our smaller neighborhood markets, we don't often get to the capacity where we have to then close off the entrances and limit number of shoppers. At PSU, we're doing that all day. And so as soon as the market opens at 8:30 on Saturdays and at PSU, we have our entrances staffed by crew members. I work at one of them myself, and we're making sure that we never go over what we've determined to be our safe capacity. And so that's something that, again, looks very different. You know, you're used to kind of walking into the park blocks and walking through, and often, you know, sitting and relaxing and doing things like that. And you know, we are set up right now to get people in, make sure that we aren't letting too many people in at a time, and then get people out as quickly as possible too.
That's great. Are you seeing similar numbers of shoppers throughout the market days, or, you know, do you think there's fewer shoppers kind of on average right now?
It's been interesting. As soon as, you know, we sort of started our COVID reaction in mid-March, we saw immediately as the story started to grow and people started to realize how bad this was going to be, that the shopper numbers went down pretty significantly. But the people who were coming were buying more. They were coming and stocking up. They were buying often for either their entire household or sometimes for other people's households too. One thing that we're really encouraging people to do is come and shop for your household rather than bring several people. So really send one person from each house and if possible, one person from a couple of houses. And we're seeing people do that. Again, it has evened out a little bit in that number of shoppers are down, size of each person's shopping trip has grown.
Really interesting. So I know that some farmers markets, and you mentioned this, are moving to allowing their vendors to do pre-orders. How is that working out at the market?
Well, we have we've been working on it in sort of stages. Again, the first thing that we did is we wanted to put together a page on our website so that no matter what our individual vendors were doing, we were supporting it. So we have such a variety of vendors, from relatively large to very, very small businesses. And so some are more able to do some to sort of pivot very quickly to some of these things than others. Now that we've had that set up and that we've been supporting that for a month or so, we are getting set up a little bit better on our own, and especially at our King Farmers Market, which is in Northeast Portland, on Sundays. We've started to work with an app called What's Good, which allows our vendors to do pre-orders and have a kind of a system for that. We're really just about 2 weeks into that, so hopefully I'll be able to report a little bit more in about a month or so when we start to really understand how it's working.
So that's basically like I could look at this app and see, you know, my favorite farm and what they have on offer and the price, and I say I want this and this and this, and then when I show up at the market, they would just have it ready for me and I pick it up and I don't even have to pay, right? Like it's already paid for?
Yeah, that's how that system works, and again, we're getting better at it as weeks go on, but we're seeing the vendors who are able to, you know, it's a commitment from the vendors because they have to put in their inventory, they have to keep up with it, and it's another job when a lot of times they're, especially the farmers, are just incredibly busy this time of year. And so, but the ones who are doing it, we hope that it'll be another way to help people spend less time in the market if that's what they're looking to do.
I know everybody's having to kind of shift their models and innovate right now, and you know, maybe using an app is a great way to do that. But I'm curious if you've heard about anything else that farms in particular are doing. I know that sales to restaurants are down because lots of restaurants are kind of streamlining their menus or have closed. But are you seeing the impact of that, or you know, seeing farms kind of shift what they're doing at the markets in other ways?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the farms in general have lost a massive revenue stream from restaurants. You know, I think we have been able to maintain, the farms that come to our markets have been doing very well at our markets, but oftentimes they're still used to be that a lot of them were making 50, sometimes more than 50% of their income from restaurants. So as good as market day looks for farmers, I don't want to understate how disruptive and how bad this has been to the small farming community. It's been a very, very hard time. I think the ways that they've been innovating around it are things like, we have seen a massive growth in the CSA model. Anything where people are able to get sort of boxes of pre-sorted food has become incredibly popular directly, you know, if you can get it directly from a producer like a farm. It does take, you know, those are systems that take a lot of time and effort to build. And so you know, farms have been trying to adjust as quickly as possible to grow. I think next year you're going to see farms doing a huge amount of CSA work. It's going to take a little bit of time to adjust. But even after this crisis is hopefully passed, I think that's something that's going to continue to be a really popular alternative.
That's a very positive thing for farmers to be able to replace some of those income streams. And farms, it takes a long time. They planned out what they were going to plant long before we had heard about the coronavirus. So it's a hard shift. I'm glad that the market's able to be more nimble and to shift much more quickly. So I'm sure you get asked about this a lot, but you know, one of the things that I love and most people love about farmers markets is the kind of energy of having a bunch of people out on a beautiful day or maybe a rainy day, you know, surrounded by vegetables and flowers, and that interaction where people are coming together and meeting each other, meeting the people who grow or like prepare their food and hanging out, you know, like that kind of interaction and community building. Is there anything that Portland Farmers Market is doing to try to kind of retain some of that or replace some of it with something else to keep that kind of momentum and excitement, but as well as keep people safe?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question and a really hard trade-off for us, because we've loved that atmosphere of farmers markets. We all work at farmers markets because we love that. And as far as replacing it, our top priority for this long has been, you know, up to this point, has really been safety and making them the healthiest places we can. And the atmosphere has unfortunately been something that we've had to trade a little bit for that. Now, the great thing is that we've, I think, a new kind of interaction and appreciation has grown up a little bit organically. Like, I don't know if we've really been responsible for it. It's been, you know, people are appreciating farmers and food in a way that a lot of people didn't a year ago. We're seeing people thank us and thank the farmers and really be incredibly appreciative that local food is available to them in this way. And I think we probably, some of us took that availability for granted before. And they're still getting the interaction with the people who are growing them when they come to the market. You're still meeting the farmers. You're just not quite able to have the, you know, the kind of laid back conversation that we may have had before. But we think, again, that the core of the experience is still there. It's just pared down a little bit.
That's great. To wrap up, you know, what can shoppers do to be prepared to shop at the market? And then where can people find Portland Farmers Market information?
Whether you're coming to our markets or any other markets in the region, I would say that the first thing is to really make sure you're looking at the Farmers Market's website before you go, because a lot of the safety procedures, the entrances, things like that are changing on a week-to-week basis. And so for any of our markets, we'd really like people to go to portlandfarmersmarket.org and look at our health and safety plan, which encompasses all of our markets, and also we have individual pages for each of the markets. It really does help to know what you want and how you're going to be able to move through the market to get it. The other thing, we do have some new relatively new community guidelines that we're asking people to adhere to. Things like, again, if at all possible, send one person rather than come in a group. Because of the fact that we're limiting the number of people, every time we have a group of three, that's two more shoppers who are waiting in line to get in. So we're really, as a kind of way of helping everybody out, we're asking everybody to please come alone. We're asking people to not bring their pets to market, except for service animals. And the other thing is, and everyone is so used to this, but we'll say it anyway, to continue to maintain 6 feet between people.
Thanks so much, Ian. I am excited to visit the market soon.
Thank you.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in